came from the community after a long day. Welcome, and I hope that you hear something that's helpful. To the retreatants, the same. We've come through another day together, the evening of the last full day of our retreat. So I'll start this one with a joke. Some of you may have heard this. But there's two, it's actually in the original, it's rabbis. Two rabbis are up by the bima, and one of them is saying, "Oh Lord, I am nothing, I am nothing." And the other prominent rabbi is, "Oh Lord, I am nothing, I am nothing." And then the janitor in the back gets really excited and wants to share in this, and he says, he drops his mop and he goes, "Oh Lord, I am nothing, I am nothing." And one of the rabbis says to the other one, "Look who thinks he's nothing." So this talk has as its theme Mara and the way that Mara can undermine us. When Eric and I were talking before I came here, when he had just invited me, he suggested that I give a talk on self-hatred and self-love. And it's sort of like my hair stood on end. It was like, ooh, that's too uji for me. I don't think I could do that, which is why I started the talk with a joke. It kind of the way I felt about his request was a little bit like when I was a little kid and I used to not like to watch people kissing in the movies. You know, it's like, ooh, man, I don't know. But I'm going to try it, and this is it. This is the result. So, just with self-love and self-hate, I would like to sort of try to avoid the whole tangled underbrush of the overlap between Buddhism and psychology. So if you feel that this veers off into that, please just forget that part of the talk if it doesn't work for you. You know, basically from the Buddhist point of view, self-hatred is just a form of anger inwardly directed and entangled in particular ways, with clinging and grasping and the false or destructive idea of the self. Eric spoke this afternoon about how, you know, sort of the world or perceptions, if we are very attached to this limited idea of a self, everything has to fit into a very small box, a very limited area. And we worked this afternoon a little bit with transferring our allegiance from the small self, or, you know, recognizing that maybe there's nothing that we see or hear that's outside of our own minds. If, you know, the body is in the mind, since the body's being seen by the mind, but then also, so is this is for the, also for the people who came from outside. If the mountain, though it appears to be distant, we see it and we're aware of it, and it's very difficult to find a boundary between ourselves and the mountain, awareness feels very continuous. So that was a practice we did this afternoon. So about these limitations, they're inherently a little problematic. But back to self-love and self-hatred, I felt much happier about giving this talk when I was looking in the life of the Buddha, and I found that he had attacks of low self-esteem even after he was enlightened. And before, I mean, maybe you've heard the story of when the Buddha was getting ready to sit under the Bodhi tree, and Mara, he's the personification of like all the bad forces of the mind. And Mara came along and said something like, you know, look who thinks he's nothing, you know, look who thinks he can like get enlightened here. And the Buddha said, well, and he touched the earth and he said, I'm going to ask the earth to be my witness that I deserve to be here. And also, haven't I prepared for this moment through about the past 10 zillion lifetimes? So, and the earth was watching me as I was trying to develop myself. And with that, the earth trembled in response to the Buddha's asking for the support of the earth. And Mara was defeated for the first time. But then even, and then, the night of the Buddha's enlightenment was basically like a big battle between Mara and his awareness, like Mara sending burning rocks and armies and, you know, maidens and flowers and kind of everything, you know, all the inner possibilities arose before him not to be liberated. But then I was really interested that after the Buddha's enlightenment, Mara came to him various times when he's out in the forest, and I'm going to read what Mara says to him. Mara goes, "Do you now dream in woods immersed in sorrow? Have you lost your wealth, or are you pining for it? Is there some crime done by you in the town? Why do you make no friends among the people? Is there none that you can call a friend? Why are you sitting out here alone? Like, you, are you depressed? You know, are you broke? Are you a criminal?" And Mara, and the Buddha responds each time, "I know you, Mara. I recognize you. I'm aware of you, and you can't get me. I have achieved a state in which you can't trick me into buying into all these statements that you've prepared for me." So by the Buddha seeing clearly, Mara is defeated. And he tries to get the Buddha first to say, "I'm not really enlightened. I don't really know what I know." And the Buddha keeps saying, "I know what I know, and I know who you are, too." Then he tries to get him not to teach. And then at some point, Mara gives this horribly pathetic speech that I've repeated to some of the yogis. He says, "When you see the boys in the village tormenting a crab, and they pull it out of the water, and they pull its legs off one by one, and then it's just lying there, and it can't do anything, that's how I feel." You almost feel sorry for him. And then he says, "Even and when a crow finds a transparent rock in the road and thinks it's a nice piece of fat, and it pecks it, and then it sees it's soft, it's not soft at all, and there's nothing for me here, and then it flies away in disappointment, hungry, that's how I feel." The Buddha has basically really mocked him. And I would also like to add that the Buddha says, you know, "I have seen the deathless." So it's not like this, there's no sense of I in the Buddha. It's not as if the Buddha has no reference point inside himself to speak of, or just can't avail himself of the relative world, or that he's become some weird, like, catatonic who can't function without a self. So then after Mara gets defeated, his daughters, who are named Craving, Boredom, and Lust, they say, "Dad, don't feel bad. We'll try to get him for you." And they say, "Well, we don't know this guy so well, but we know that, like, guys like women, so, like, but we don't know exactly what kind he likes, so we're going to send every kind." And then there's a list of all the kinds of women that Craving and Boredom and Lust send out, like this army of women, and, you know, young ones, old ones, ones who've had children, ones who haven't, virgins, you know, like very experienced women, and, you know, all kinds. And to kind of just try to draw him in. And, you know, this is an idea sort of about the seduction of the plots that our mind tries to drag us into, seeing the world dualistically. And the Buddha responds to them, too, somewhat derisively, and says, you know, it's like you've just tried to chew something made out of iron, split a rock with lily stems, climb a cliff with a rock on your head, or push down a tree with your chest. You know, you can't get me, girls. And yet, he's affected by this big parade. And the next speech that he gives to his monks is the fire sermon. So, you know, actually the Buddha still seems to have some kind of inner process going on, that, like, there is some, you know, he does respond to events, too. You know, I think it sounds to me like he's a little bit disgusted. You know, the eye is burning, the ear is burning, the forms are burning, you know. Like, I just got rid of those Mara ladies, and wow. You know. Yeah. So anyway, Sayadaw Upandita used to say to us, don't feel sorry for Mara, don't feel sorry for the defilements. Just when you see them, you know, crush and defeat them with mindfulness. And that was one of Sayadaw Upandita's kind of hair-raising statements, like, you don't have to be merciful and compassionate towards everything. These forces in your mind are not me, they're not mine, they're not you. They carefully craft their messages so that you will buy into them, so that you really will believe them. You know, it's sort of this sometimes when the mind is very still, like today, I sort of had this feeling like it was kind of like I was looking down through still, clear water, and some squid just sort of puffed out this big cloud of sort of mental toxin and anguish. And there it was. And, I felt the mental pain, and I felt the tendency to want to sort of start to buy into this sort of big cloud of stuff. And yet at the same time, I could also see, you know, this is anger, this is pain, this is mental suffering. So as Eric has been instructing a lot, not to believe the story, not to buy into a lot of these messages. And what's weird is that we tend to really want to. Like, for me, like, if I can't sell my novel, then I really suck totally in every way, you know. I put all this energy into it, you know. Failure in that would mean something really bad about me. And I would, you know, and because I want to believe in the fairness of the literary market or something, you know, there's all kinds of reasons why I would like to, you know, grasp onto this thought when it comes and put myself into a state of fear. And what we don't see at the time when we're so, like, ready, just pulled in by these possibilities for ourselves, you know, sort of to go down this road, whether shorter or farther. I mean, we all know that we can go quite far down the road of self-hatred and self-doubt and self-loathing. We're not really aware of the wounds that we're inflicting on ourselves by adopting these points of view. We can wound our hearts, our minds, even our bodies in extreme cases can get wounded by self-hatred. Ajahn Buddhadasa calls this the life that bites. And he talks a lot about having a life that doesn't bite, even saying that it doesn't mean that you can't get married or have relationships, but that you need to learn how to be free within those relationships and not say, for example, that your partner is mine or need them to be in a certain way to allow the space to let them have a kind of flow. Now, I know that this is very schematic, because sometimes when you get down in the nitty-gritty, these things are so seductive and they happen so fast that it's very difficult not to be pulled in. But when we watch it again and again, we can begin to recognize the mental toxins as such. I guess the comparison for why it's hard came to me. It's sort of like trying to repair your car while it's on the highway. You know, sometimes it feels that way. Even when we're sitting here, you know, you can just spend all afternoon embroiled in something. And yet all the practices of Buddhism aim at this one thing, to not possess life, to not lay that claim on your partner or on things or on people or on self. And it's truly this appreciation of the vastness of the ground of our being, say like when the Buddha touched the earth, also making that connection with kind of everything or the all and ourselves as arising as an expression within everything and as inseparably interconnected with it, seamlessly interconnected with it and divided off by only the very like thinnest of conceptual lines. I mean, they've been studying the brain, and you know, there is no little, you know, like how, you know how the heavy machinery has that little glass cabin with a guy in there doing like this. Well, there's nobody in your head who's doing this, you know, and there's not even one place where everything's going on. It's like your sort of mind processes things in this, you know, very flashing way all around the brain at all times, and from the senses and from vision, and it sort of puts it together, but. You know, it's just a very strange thing that we really think that me is the essence of myself. But emptiness and seeing that Mara, knowing Mara well, for example, knowing that Mara is just a thought and is not necessarily me and is not, also this is really interesting, is not caused by me. It's not my fault that I have, like, these difficult thoughts. To be able to begin to see the emptiness of this is part of what allows us to invite the other parts of ourselves to this party of our life. I'm aware that this retreat is occurring somewhat around the holiday of Halloween, and encouraging us to think of our inner experiences, the good ones and the bad ones, as something like emptiness in disguise. Sort of the angels and the demons that we meet in ourselves. And since we're here with an English PhD as the other teacher, I'm going to read a line from The Fairy Queen, which is a great work of literature. There's a character called the Archimago who he's trying to scare this princess. And he hates her. So for her he hated as the hissing snake, and in her many troubles did most pleasure take. He then devised himself how to disguise, for by his mighty science he could take as many forms and shapes in seeming wise as ever Proteus to himself could make. Sometimes a fowl, sometimes a fish in lake, now like a fox, now like a dragon fell, that of himself he oft for fear would quake and would try to fly away. Oh, who can tell? So he scares himself, basically. He, like, gets all wrapped up in, you know, sort of what he's made out of himself, and then he's afraid, and he tries to fly away from himself. And so how do we train our mind not to be afraid of itself in all of its many disguises? This ephemeral thing that is occurring within us, that's our process, that if you look at it from the particular angle of seeing its emptiness, it has no shape, it has no form, it has no particular location. It can't be fixed. It's never, you know, it's always moving. It's different now than it was this morning. And how is it that we get so stuck in the solidity of suffering? Because it's when our experience starts to get solidified that we really suffer. So, what is it that we want? You know, we can say that suffering is necessary or something like that, and or that, you know, it's something really important, or that it's, even sometimes people say it's good. But when we're feeling suffering, we definitely don't want it, true or false. Like when, right? Okay, well, that's agreed. No abstraction there. What do we want instead? Happiness and pleasure all the time? How about that? Don't we? Wouldn't we like to have that, happiness and pleasure all the time? But we seem to not be able to achieve happiness and pleasure all the time, no matter struggle how we might. So far, you know, most of us have reached a fairly advanced age and not been able to line up pleasure all the time. And it's just not doable. So pleasure and pain and boredom alternate. And the untrained mind reacts by resisting and attaching and spacing out. And it's natural. There's no one is to blame for this. It's kind of, this is what a human being does unless we learn to do something different. And so the training process is what helps us undermine these forces of Mara and self-hatred. I recently went to a lecture in Boston that was by the most popular course ever given at Harvard. It had 900 students last year, and it was on positive psychology, or the psychology of happiness, which is a huge new field, very important. And there's a lot of good books about it. The lecturer was named Tal Ben-Shahar, who used to be the squash champion of Israel. And he said he got into positive psychology because all of his squash triumphs didn't make him happy. Like, he could feel the happiness of each triumph, and yet they didn't add up to a totally happy life. And he saw that there has to be something else cultivated, a different kind of understanding than just, you know, going training and winning and training and winning and training and winning eventually wasn't enough for him. So in this sort of broad strokes I'll do here, that you know, this small self of ours that is a kind of structure in our psyche, it needs things and events to be happening that are positive. And it's very fragile. It tends to defend its territory. And it's not the same as having a deeper sense of confidence and fortitude that's available. That if you know, I think a lot of us fear, like, if we get rid of our quote-unquote self, that we'll lose kind of everything. And that's actually Mara talking again. Like, if you don't please and satisfy me, then you'll have nothing, and you'll be destitute, and you'll be out there in the forest all alone without a friend, like a criminal, and no money, and all the rest. You know, you got to buy into me, or else you'll end up kind of like the Buddha. So So not to stay within that frame of reference that Mara has set up for us, and all of those images, like that the children are playing on the roof of the burning house, it's like, were we really to taste the deathless, we would really love it. It's not like a bad thing. It's not like a horrible emptiness. And the positive news also is that the mind can be trained to learn how to recognize and disentangle from some of Mara's traps. The Buddha said, "Bhikkhus, it is by ordered attention and ordered effort that I have attained the deathless and gone beyond suffering. And bhikkhus, it is by ordered attention and ordered effort that you too will attain the deathless and go beyond suffering." So that's what we're attempting to do here, you know, in our own messy, imperfect way, and yet we have to sort of be involved in it while we're doing it. That's like, you know, repairing the car while you're driving down the highway sometimes at 80 miles an hour. Take out the carburetor here. But there is a real art to this, and like all arts, it takes cultivation. It can take a lifetime of cultivation, a very intimate personal work. Learning how to cultivate positive attitudes and attributes at the same time as disentangling from some of the negative ones. And there are very, very many techniques that we can use, you know, imagery, metta practice, therapy, going out in nature, all kinds of healing forces, therapy, trying to receive love, finding, you know, contexts, you know, that are more supportive. But since we're in a Buddhist retreat here, I'll just sort of try to talk about recognizing things within the nature of emptiness and trying to free the emotions in that way in the present moment. Because if we can learn to disentangle from the arising of painful emotions in the present moment, then the past has less and less influence upon us. Like, there may be reasons why many of us have difficulties in the present moment, and we talked about some of them in the Q&A this afternoon. But if we free them in the moment of arising, then we render those past experiences less and less powerful and eventually possibly powerless over us. So imagining, say, bringing to mind an experience that this is something maybe to do a little bit, you know, not now, and some of you may not want to do it at all. I'm just going to run through it very quickly right now. But say, bringing to mind an experience where you felt some slight irritation, maybe a person that you vaguely dislike. Like, again, as in metta practice, when you're practicing with a difficult person, not the worst experience you ever had, but something that left you feeling a little grouchy. So bring that to mind and feel the emotion of anger or dissatisfaction or irritation, and feel that emotion as an object. Don't unite your mind with it. Don't buy into it. And see if you can understand it as a mere phenomenon and possibly feel it in the body the way we were saying. Make the awareness as large as it needs to be, and watch at the same time your tendency to want to get drawn in. Like, it should be an irritation that it has some freshness to it, you know. And see, play back and forth between seeing the feeling as a feeling and the temptation to go to the story. And what happens when you want to go to the story is usually when you start to see the object of your irritation more clearly, like you see that person doing that thing, rather than feeling the anger inside yourself. So you might want to play with this. Stare at the emotion itself and see what is it made of. Recognize it as a mental thing or as a thought, and try to understand in that the nature of thinking itself. It's also interesting to play with when you're in a actually stuck feeling place in the practice itself, and see, what does it mean that these things feel so solid in my mind, that these things feel so real, when in fact they're devoid of intrinsic existence? Then allow, you know, with this exercise, then after you've stared at the emotion for a while, allow it to dissipate to avoid kind of getting into a chain reaction. Sort of the chain reaction where you lay out all the faults of the situation or of your enemy. You know, you scorn them, you plan to defeat them, you fantasize about revenge, etc. Understand, you know, see how they can one day understand all the pain that they've caused you and the misery that that you've undergone will all be transferred to them and is only what they deserve. Like that. By the time you've gone that far, you know, usually you're pretty stuck. So this is also not to say that I think that there are kind of sort of positive moments of anger, usually in a moment, like a sense of some kind of indignation, some, you know, where you do like stop someone right there and say like, look, you know, you're not helping the situation right now. But one of the ways of assessing whether or not, you know, there's anything worthwhile about one's negative emotions is the ultimate effect of how much harm do they do. Like, usually, if you intervene in an angry way, you either burn out or you cause conflict, or, you know, the conflict then becomes about how angry you are instead of about what it was really about or what you wanted to talk about in the first place. You know, and it's very difficult for people to hear you when you come at them with, you know, 8,000 tons of energy. So we're trying to unpack here our reactivity. It's good to be able to really feel your emotions inside yourself and within your own process. So to like drop a little bit out of the story and start to feel where you're really at. And very often this can teach you a lot of things about yourself. For example, you know, when someone's apparent virtues are really based on rigidity or something like that, or you can learn that inside yourself, what your emotions and your actions really do mean, if you're in touch with what is really driving you, what kind of intention you have behind what you say. Like, maybe you think you're being very loving and stuff like that, but really you're not. You can start to really feel those. And if you're less afraid of your feelings by recognizing that they are just arisings in the mind, then you will be a lot freer to understand yourself and to begin to unhook from some of the patterns that cause pain with yourself and other people. So seeing it with this type of clarity that doesn't lead you also then to start to beat up on yourself, to really sort of be able to have some of the space to let yourself understand these emotions in yourself. So there are times when a friend may tell you in the most loving way that you're going wrong, or that they may be able to point out some of your character issues with so much love that you don't feel wounded or hurt or blamed, that you feel that this person's actually helping you to see yourself and love yourself more. So that would be the spirit in which to be able to do this. It's so touching, actually. It's such a service when people can do that. It reminds me of, you know, the word when we take refuge at the beginning of the retreat. There's a translator who has translated this as taking safe direction from the Buddha and the Guru and the Dharma and the Sangha. And I really like that formulation, because it's sort of like taking a new direction, but it's also sort of like being willing to take some direction from the Dharma and the Buddha, like from the practices of morality and concentration and wisdom. That in morality, you know, you really, like, you just don't do some of the things that you might, you know, impulsively do. So that's sort of taking some direction from the ethical guidelines and precepts of Buddhism. I'm reminded of the nuns that I stayed with this summer in a cave in India. And one of the things about the caves was that it wasn't the way that I had thought at all. Like, I thought, meditate in a cave, I'll be all alone in this like splendid solitude and looking out across these mountains and stuff. Well, actually, it was an experience of community and really being nurtured and also being fed, and also being fed, you know, quite a lot of things that I might have rather not have eaten. And eat, you know, like this. And, you know, I had a lot of experiences about my mom and stuff. But the nun that I stayed with, and also I had to talk to her for about an hour and a half, like three times a day after, while she was making the meals and stuff. Yet I had amazing practice also at the same time, because it was also tranquil. There were trees and birds and just this very natural feeling there. A community of practitioners who were really, you know, doing it, getting up at 4, practicing for a couple hours, eating breakfast, practicing after breakfast, little socializing, little lunch, little practice in the afternoon, little socializing, little this and that, dinner, and then staying up late at night and practicing. And you could hear them with their drums and their bells and their kind of wild chanting up the hill in the darkness. It was great. But there were, in this cave, rats, centipedes, flies, cockroaches, fleas, you know, bed bugs. And every day this nun would trap a rat. Every single day she would trap a rat in this live trap, and then she'd go on a long walk to let it out, and then she'd come back and stuff. And one day it was raining, and there were like hand-sized spiders crawling all over the walls of my cave. And, you know, and I would always sit and say, and you could hear them at night, too, eating bugs, like crunching up the skeletons of bugs at night. And I would think, like, please don't fall in my bed, please, you know. And then the day that one of them started giving birth to thousands and thousands of baby spiders, that was when I hit the edge. And I actually took it outside. I took this mother spider outside. She had this giant, gross white thing underneath her that was like this egg case that was emitting, like, live baby spiders by the hundreds. And you know, so the nun comes out, like, she hears me, you know, like, what are you doing? And she said, oh, you know, it's giving birth, you know, like that. And I'm like, yeah, I can't have it in the cave. And she says, well, we have to cover it up, you know, because these babies are going to drown in the rain. So she put a little piece of cardboard over it. And then she said, no, come in my cave and have some tea. And I was like, all rattled, so sure, you know, endless cups of tea, you know. And so I said, haven't you ever been tempted to just, like, get a bug fogger or something, you know? and she, because as we were talking in the tea, she was like, God, these bugs, you know, I really hate this, you know, they're so horrible, you know, they drive me crazy, you know. And I think she was embarrassed too, because I'm an American, you know, and I've seen this, like, squalor that she was in. And then I said, well, they're obviously getting on your nerves, you know. And she's like, well, I would never kill them, you know, this is my practice place. I've taken a vow of non-harming. How can you even suggest that I would kill them, these horrible bugs, you know? So it's like she took a direction in herself with the bugs. Then later on I was talking to her about her escape from Tibet, and this actually goes to a profound level about the discipline of mind that she took to see all events as practice, everything that happened to her as part of her practice. When she saw the Chinese kill her mother and her sister, and she decided she should leave. So she and her teacher started walking, and they walked out of Tibet, and they were in India as beggars. They, you know, shared food and lodging with the poorest people. And she said she was very, very touched by Indian people just taking care of all the Tibetans. But they basically walked, you know, hundreds of miles. They had nothing. They had to, you know, really endure a lot. And I said, you know, and I said, like, so what was this like for you? You know, I felt I'd gotten to know her pretty well by then. So I said, you know, like, did you get depressed or anything? And she said, it was a lot of Dharma, kind of like that. You know, just, it was a big practice for me to do this. It really moves me to think of her, you know, ability to practice that way. Then later on, I asked her and her neighbor, like, I was living in a sort of a duplex cave, and she had a fridge, she had electric light, they had linoleum, they had beds, you know, it was not a pretty plushy cave, you know, with a nice view and stuff. I sort of felt like I could stay there forever. You could reach everything from your bed, you know, the book, the tea, pretty good, the view outside. And so the young nun who had abdicated her cave so that I could practice there, which is another kind of Asian thing, like, when they want to treat you well, boy, they really can just make you feel like now you really should practice. And I'd say to her, like, well, you know, don't you want your cave back? Like, you've displaced yourself. She was living down the hill in one room with her uncle. And she goes, well, if you practice there or I practice there, I don't see the big difference. Someone's practicing in the cave, you know, and I can practice down here. And then, my grumbly friend said, she just wants to go down and talk on her cell phone and run around with all her friends, you know. But no, she'd actually moved out of her house. And I kept being, like, really paranoid about, like, does she want it back? Does she want it back? And she never did. And the day when she came up to spend the day, it was like, well, she said she hadn't seen me enough, like, she's my friend and she wanted to spend time. But I asked them when they were together, like, do you guys ever fight? You know, you've been living with one thin wall between you for about 20 years. And they said, fight? No. Fight? Why would we fight? And I'm like, well, because you share one thin wall and you eat it every single meal together for 20 years. Like, have you ever found anything to fight about? Well, no, honestly, we wouldn't. All we do is eat together and practice together. Like, there's no reason for us to fight. You know, and I went on and on with it. And they said, well, then they started trying to make me feel better. They said, well, maybe if we had some sheep that we were trying to raise or something, maybe then we'd fight. But we don't fight. Anyway, so that's the practice with them. So really being willing sometimes to move your mind to another place. Like, sometimes it really takes some, you know, the willingness from whatever resources. So in closing, I'd like to read a poem that was published by one of the yoga teachers that I've worked with in the Northeast. And it's just by one of his students. She's named Manzanoff, and it's called Autumn. Urge me, drop every leaf I don't need, every task or habit I repeat past its season, every sorrow I rehearse, each unfulfilled hope that I recall, every person or possession to which I cling until my branches are bare, until I hold fast to nothing. Tutor me through straining night winds in the passion of moan and pant, the gift of letting go at the moment of most abundance, in the way of falling apples, figs, maple leaves, pecans. Show me the way of dying in glorious boldness, yellow, gold, orange, rust, red, and burgundy. So to not be afraid of letting go, to let go into totality rather than feeling you're going to let go into nothing or a hole or an absence, because that's not nature. Nature sort of abhors a vacuum. Mm-hmm. Well, let's sit together a little bit.